flayed hounds, spinning masses of limbs and light, rotting insects as large as battle tanks. The lichway shakes. Pillars shatter. The governor called silence whimpers from her place beneath his throne. Her mouth is sewn shut, her tongue taken. The whimper pulses through the Psi Titan's body instead, and Borealis Thune roars into the oncoming storm. Animus, says Hydrogyrum, and turns the crucible into the first of its greater alignments. Deep in Borealis Thune's body, the sleepers awake. They have lain in their crystal coffins, dreamless, their bodies wrapped in amnion. Each of them is a psyker, and as each of them wakes, they scream. Psychic power lashes through the Titan's frame. Lightning and frost roll across its skin. Unnatural energies rush through etheric conduits and meet the blackness at the Titan's heart. In his throne, Hydrogyrum watches as the symbols of the four cardinal elements shift into alignment and begin to orbit him. Warp power is spinning around the darkness of his presence like a cyclone, accelerating and growing. Etherica, he says, and nudges the orbiting symbols into a different path. The power rolling over Borealis Thune vanishes. A wave of stillness ripples outwards. The tide of demons falters. Creatures of blurred fury and stolen flesh slow in their stride. Cries hoot through the air. At Hydrogyrum's feet, the last of the trio of governors convulses. This last human has no eyelids, and his mouth is an open cave of metal. Interface cables slot into his skull on each side where his ears once were. He is called Pain, and he screams without sound. Borealis Thune begins to walk. The wall of demons bends backwards, churning like the sea retreating from the shore. Blackness gathers in the maw of the weapon that hangs from the Titan's left arm. On his throne, Hydrogyrum waits until the control sphere is a blur. Then he sits back. A single obsidian globe spins to stillness just in front of his left hand. The demonic tide is rippling as the pressure pushing it forwards backs up behind its faltering charge. Null, says Hydrogyrum, and taps the globe. The Imperial Palace. Before. The sky above Terra was blue. Pollution hung in a haze that ran to the edge of sight. Prefect Hydrogyrum walked alone along the top of the Sinopian wall towards the Anatolia spires. Sunlight caught the subtle patterns of thorns woven into the black fabric of his coat. A high collar ringed his neck. His head was clean-shaven. Silver plugs capped the mind interface sockets at the base of his skull. Black tattoos covered the left of his face, turning half of his sharp features into a mask of nightmare. Anyone who could look at him for long enough to note any such details would find no insignia or sign of office besides the lion's head ring on his left index finger. And no one he passed looked at him. They turned their eyes and hurried away. If asked, none of them would be able to say why they did not want to look at the thin man in black. A lucky few would say that they could not remember him at all. That did not bother Hydrogyrum. Outwardly, he seemed a human just like those that passed on his walk across the walls. He was not human, though, any more than a statue of a man was a man. He was inhuman. He was pariah. He knew this, and had known it ever since he had been old enough to hold a thought. He presumed that his family had seen it in him, which was why they had left him on the refuse range to die. The strange child with the eyes that made people shiver, and who did not cry when they left him to the wolves and the winds. But like everything in the pattern of the universe, he had his place. A place and a purpose. He walked on along the top of the walls. Lifter towers marched across the flanks of the defences. Huge blocks of raw stone swung up into the sky in the jaws of cranes. When the wind shifted, he could hear the rhythmic calls of labour gangs as they hacked and hammered at stone and steel. The palace was different from when he had last walked under the sun. While war raged in the tunnels beyond the Emperor's dungeon, a different face of the same war had come to the world above. Neither the war beyond the Golden Throne, nor the growing fortress above, had touched him in the buried stronghold of Borealis Chamber far to the north. He and his machine had waited long to be called. He paused for a moment on the crest of a flight of steps, and spent exactly 2 minutes watching the flow of movements amongst the labourers. He would be on time, even with this delay. The walk had helped him balance his body's humours. That was good. He needed to be ready for the debate. The wind skimmed the bare flesh of his scalp and flicked the edge of his coat as he turned away. The sound of armour and active weaponry filled his ears as he began down the steps again. A giant in amber-yellow battle-plate barred his path, weapon levelled.
"Identify yourself and give reason for your presence."
Hydrogyrum tilted his head. The giant was one of the Imperial Fists, a veteran, 675th Company, 20 years since induction according to his honours and unit markings. The willpower that the warrior was showing by confronting Hydrogyrum was impressive. To look at him for so long must have caused the Space Marine actual pain.
"Allow me to pass," said Hydrogyrum.
He knew what must have happened. The ring on his finger had unlocked every portal and door he had come across since he had risen from his chamber's Arctic stronghold and come south. The Imperial Fists had noticed his presence on the wall and backtracked to find out that he had gained access via a cipher key. They would not have been able to identify the key's origin, and so they had come to find out who walked so freely in their domain. The fact that the access codes held in Hydrogyrum's ring were valid and exotic was likely the only reason that this warrior of Dawn had not gunned him down on sight.
"You will answer, or you will die where you stand," said the legionary.
Hydrogyrum turned his gaze full on the warrior. The monster of armour and gene-crafted flesh visibly flinched, but held his aim steady. Hydrogyrum turned his left palm over and tapped the ring with the tip of his thumb. A cone of hollow light sprang from the ring. The image of a lion's head rotated in the projection, sunlight bleaching the image but somehow robbing it of none of its ferocity. Rings of data and information spun around it. The Imperial Fist gazed at it for a second, and then stepped back, dropping his aim and bowing his head briefly.
"My apologies," he said.
Hydrogyrum lowered his hand, the authority of his ordo vanishing. He looked at the warrior for a second, and then walked on without a word. When he came to the Tower of the Sickle Moon, the assembled custodian guard did not try to bar his path. They knew better. He ascended the 777 steps to the chamber at the tower's summit. Three figures waited for him, a custodian, one of the Silent Sisterhood, and a tech priest. Hydrogyrum took each of them in as he crossed the chamber floor. His eyes noted the geometry of the architecture, the subtle and obvious symbolism of angles, the placement of flame for light, water for reflection, and black stone for the table at the centre of the room. Four silver cups sat on the tabletop. He walked to his place.
"Your names?" he said.
The custodian flicked a glance at the Null Maiden. She remained still, her eyes unblinking and icy above a silver mask.
"I am Chul," said the custodian.
"That is not your full and true name," said Hydrogyrum.
"The thread of my true name is mine alone. Be satisfied with Chul, Prefect."
Hydrogyrum considered, gave a short nod, and looked at the Silent Sister. She met his gaze. He wondered for a second if the other two presumed kinship in that look, the two soulless ones finding themselves mirrored in the other's eyes. He felt nothing, though, and if the Null Maiden did, then she gave no sign.
"I am familiar with your symbolic gesture system," he said to her. "You may use it to answer me."
She raised an eyebrow and flicked her fingers.
"Varna?" he said aloud. "My thanks."
"Agates Kamma," said the tech priest in turn.
"Chul Varna Agates Kamma. I am named Hydrogyrum. I am the fourth prefect of the Borealis, and I answer your call.
You are late, said the tech priest, his voice a rattle of tiny gears.
Hydrogyrum ignored the words. What is it that you would ask of the Ordo Sinister? He asked.
We ask that you walk to war, Jewel replied.
The Webway. Now.
The beam rips across the space between Borealis Thune and the tide of demons. Blackness runs down the beam's core. Light shatters around it. Sound flattens. Screams, howls, and hoots lose distance and volume. The beam strikes. The first demons in its path vanish. One moment they are bounding forward, and the next they do not exist. The beam begins to shriek. Cold light whips around it. Colours pour into it. The demons run, clawing at each other, leaping up the curved walls of the lichway to get away from the darkness shearing through them. They are creatures without fear, without the nature to feel any true emotion, yet they run from Borealis Thune. Hydrogyrum watches as the beam carves through them. The crucible is spinning into a new alignment around him. Borealis Thune will not be able to maintain fire for more than a few more seconds. He pushes the black globe back into orbit amongst the elements spinning in the crucible. The beam blinks out of existence. Light and sound roar back into full force. The demons hold still for an instant, and then flow down the walls again. The third and first cardinal elements are smoking as they spin past Hydrogyrum. Blood will be staining the amniotic caskets of the two psychers. They will last only a little longer. But Borealis Thune has other teeth. The crucible slows its spin. Hydrogyrum reaches for the sigils for sulphur, fire, silver. The turbo lasers on the Titan's back gather charge. The demons cross the distance in a stuttering blink. Their substance thins as they close. Flesh unravels from them like sand blown from the face of a dune. The turbo lasers fire. Sun-white beams lance out, punching into the horde, cutting through plague-bloated bodies, blasting gleaming skin and muscle to black slime. Inside Borealis Thune's skull, the governor named Silence is breathing hard, trembling with the connection to the machine's weapons. The demons keep pouring down the spiral of the lichway. The glowing tips of alien pillars project from the surface of the swelling flow of monsters. The air is blazing with ghost light. Slaved weapons fire from beneath the Borealis Thune's carapace. Bolt rounds and lasfires sleet down as the flow of monsters spills around its feet. Fanged mouths bay in its shadow. Ash falls from them as they try to hold onto their forms. Hydrogyrum notes the demon's proximity as a flash of hololithic light in the crucible. Elements and symbols shift to his will. Void shields snap into being around the Titan, wrapping it in layers of energy. A pulse of telekinetic force rips out from the Titan's body, and half-dissolved demons scatter into the air. Borealis Thune strides into the Sea of Horrors. The lichway quakes under its tread. The ghostly substance of the webway trembles, as though fighting the presence of the Titan. Bone and crystal pillars shatter as it passes. Hydrogyrum notes each effect and alteration, and pushes Borealis Thune on into the tide, even as it rises to meet him. The plan had been simple, its need direct. The war waged in the labyrinth of the webway was not like battles fought on planets or in the void. The enemy faced by the custodians, sisters of silence, and machine cultists was endless. The demons of the warp could not be killed. Their power would wax and wane. Sometimes they were few, sometimes they were numberless. Their strength could be terrifying, and it could not be defeated. It was a constant pressure beyond the walls of the webway, always trying to find a way in, always seeking for weaknesses. The aim of the Emperor's forces was not to destroy the demons, but to push them back and shut them out of the sections of webway that they could hold. It was not like fighting an army. It was like trying to control a wildfire. Lightning crackles through the air before Borealis Thun, as it marches up the spiral curve. The demons retreat before the Black Titan, but they are not defeated. Hydrogyrum has faced them before. He can read the pattern of their disorder. Just as the brightest flame brings the largest insects to its light, so does the greatest battle attract the greatest of demons. The horde of lesser creatures' parts, draining from the broken pillars, bloated things of forged red metal and bleeding muscles scuttle forwards. Some hoist into the air on tattered wings. They grow as they move, sucking etheric power into themselves. Multicolored fire pours at Borealis Thun from every direction. Glowing bullets rattle into the air and kiss its void shields. The layers of energy shimmer, popping and foaming with explosions. Hydrogyrum feels the fields begin to flutter. His mind is a blur of transpositions as he tries to reshape the intricate balances of the Psi Titan. A telekinetic enfolding could make them proof against the deluge, but only for a time. If he shifts the etheric elements to repel the demon engine's fire, then they will be expended. Renewal will take time. That is why the void shields are there, to buy him precious minutes more. The half-machine demons are swarming forward, spitting energy and acid. The light beyond the Titan's eyeports is a migraine smear of colour. The first layer of void shields collapses with a whip-crack of thunder, then the next, and the next. The crucible whirls, elements moving out of alignment. Hydrogyrum feels his muscles clench as he braces. The first kiss of demon fire touches Borealis Thun's metal skin. The Titan shudders in pain and rage. Hydrogyrum feels it. He is not a creature of emotion, his soul a black mirror that reflects no light of joy or anger. But he feels the rage and pain of the machine he walks with. His hands snap the crucible around. The governor servitor called Pain vomits blood from the plug of its mouth. Worms of witchfire wash through the Titan's bridge. A glowing arc earths in the sphere of the crucible and vanishes. The obsidian globe spins towards Hydrogyrum's fingers, and he catches it from the air. The beam of unlight lashes from Borealis Thun's left arm. The half-machine demons cease to be. Hydrogyrum holds the crucible still as the elements try to wrench free of the alignment he has set them in. The Titan is shuddering as it walks. Light is falling into it, spiraling into its shadow. The three governors beneath Hydrogyrum's throne spasm. The black beam of annihilation continues to pour from the Titan, slicing through demons like a scythe set to corm. Then the beam is no longer there. There is a stitch of time, a second pulled out to an eternity. Hydrogyrum still has his hand on the black sphere, but two of the four cardinal elements have swung out of place. Data spirals around him. All of it is red.
Alkahest, he says,
and yanks two levers set into the right arm of his throne. Deep within Borealis Thun, two blood- and amnion-filled sarcophagi pull out of their sockets as machine arms hoist them away. Cables and pipes snap free of the crystal cases. Cooked meat and blistered skin floats in the sloshing fluid. For a brief moment, both sarcophagi hang, and then they drop through a hatch and into the waiting fire. Fresh caskets are already in place. Cables lock into their sockets.
Animus, says Hydrogyrum, high up in the Titan's skull.
The figures in the crystal sarcophagi twitch. Drugs pour into their veins, ripping back the comfort of sleep. Frost flashes over the cases and up their conduits. Matrices of crystal threaded through the Titan's bones light with fresh fire. Hydrogyrum watches as the four cardinal elements begin to turn again. The psychers will be wakened and ready within seconds, but he does not have seconds. Out beyond the Titan's eyes, the demon tide is deepening as bodies scramble and pile over one another, like wasps crowding a queen. Something is bulging beneath the carpet of horrors.
Etherica,
he intones, and power lashes through the Titan. He flushes it to the turbolasers and void shields.
The rearing carpet of demons peels back. The creature beneath is a sculpture cut in darkness, outlined in furnace glow. Its form swells, billowing up to fill the curve of the tunnel. Jaws yawn wide, fire framing the night-filled mouth within. Its shape changes as it grows. Shadows of wings, hints of muscle and quills, glimpses of blisters and burning eyes trapped in a serrated shadow. Hydrogyrum cannot see this demon. His mind offers it no mirror of fear. Darkness, the blind governor of the Titan's senses, can see the creature, though. Its image uncoils in the crucible's hollow projections. The monstrous shape flickers, looming, a vast blister of abomination forced through the skin of sanity. The elements of the control crucible spin faster. Borealis Thune's psychic might is ascending, but it cannot be brought into alignment yet. Hydrogyrum smiles. The demon before him has waited until just this moment to manifest. While the fresh psychers mesh with the spirit of Borealis Thune, it is just a titan like any other.
Clever, he says to himself,
and fires the turbo-lasers. Spears of sunbright fire stab at the demon. It changes, flowing forwards like a flock of carrion birds. Borealis Thune turns, weapons pivoted, slicing fire after the creature. It is faster. It passes through the Titan's void shields with a rippling boom. Curtains of light flash into being and vanish. Hydrogyrum steps the machine back, but the demon is rising, its scattered form gathering into a serpentine body. Its substance is blurring, dust and shadows spilling behind it as it pushes against the presence of the Psi-Titan. Lesser creatures will be destroyed by the close presence of Borealis Thune, but this beast is an exalted thing of chaos, and the warp pours into its being faster than it can be unmade. A long head of scales and teeth forms at the end of its body as it coils around the Titan. Hydrogyrum can see only darkness beyond the Titan's eyes. In the hollow projection, the demon's mouth opens again with a scream of burning cities. The Imperial Palace. Before.
What you are proposing is...
It is the will of the Omnissiah,
snapped Agates Gamma. The tech priest's eyes whirred, and the green lenses snapped to red. Hydrogyrum turned his gaze on the man.
The Emperor wills, and Borealis obeys. The Ordo obeys. All obey, he said,
voice flat and level.
But you are not his voice, nor is your will his.
Agates Gamma bridled. Chrome and brass mechadendrites coiled over his shoulders.
Prefect Hydrogyrum, Jewel began,
the custodian's voice a smooth rumble. Hydrogyrum decided instead to clarify his point.
The Emperor's will is that the war in the tunnels beyond the dungeon be won, he said. You are correct in that. Our Ordo and the Chamber Borealis has served in that endeavour. We knew then that he willed that we walk the labyrinth, but that does not mean that he wills us to take this place in it now. The past is not the future. If he wished it otherwise, he would command us.
Chul held Hydrogyrum's gaze. The custodian did not flinch. They rarely did, even when Hydrogyrum focused his entire attention on them.
If your chamber will not agree, said Chul, then the proposition can be made to one of the others.
Hydrogyrum shrugged.
You may approach them, he said. You believe that they would refuse?
Varna asked the question with quick movements of her fingers. Hydrogyrum turned his palms face up on the tabletop.
They may or they may not, he said. Your plan is to relieve pressure on the main transits of the webway that we still hold. You intend your unifier artisans to shore up and extend the sections behind. You also hope to annihilate as much of the demonic incursion as you can, so sapping their strength for a time.
You believe that the scheme is flawed?
hissed Agates Gamma. "You are proposing provoking a large-scale incursion of the Neverborn into the Webway, and then channeling it into a single location where its energy and substance can be nullified. At best, it is a temporary relieving of the pressure that they are exerting on our forces in the tunnels, like bleeding a fever victim, or letting fire consume the forest it feeds on. It is not a cure."
Tuol turned his head and reached for the helm clamped to his armor. The gesture had the finality of a falling blade.
"Very well," said the custodian. "You have our thanks for attending, Prefect. We will explore other options."
"I did not say that we would not comply with your request," said Hydrogyrum.
Tuol looked at him, a frown creasing the custodian's face. Agates Gamma stirred and shifted, his servos and gears clicking in puzzlement.
"Your previous statements held a contradictory implication to what you have just stated."
"I stated facts. I did not offer a denial," said Hydrogyrum, tilting his head to look at the tech priest. "I would hope that one of your caste could appreciate that."
"So you will walk with us," Varna signed.
"No," he said. "We will not walk with you. I will walk alone. When the tide comes, I will face it, while you do what you need to."
"But,"
began the tech priest, "all of your forces will have their parts to play. The beasts must be driven to the killing ground. But I shall be the reaper."
"Why?"
asked Varna. "Why have I agreed? Or why do I say that I walk alone?"
"Both."
"I agreed because no other can do what you need, because you were not created for annihilation, no matter what use our master puts you to. Because the Ordo Sinister exists to face such foes. And I agreed because he would wish it, even if he has not ordered it."
Silence followed his words. The Null Maiden, custodian, and tech priest were watching him with unblinking intensity. One after another, they nodded acknowledgement.
"The Ordo Sinister shall walk," he added.
The Webway, now. Fire cloaks Borealis Thun. Black lacquer blisters on its skin. The demon serpent vomits flame as it spirals around the Titan. The tide of lesser demons surges forward like plains jackals and carrion feeders made bold by the bleeding lion. Inside the Titan's skull, Hydrogyrum feels scorching heat spread over his skin. He is a psychic void, but he is linked to the Borealis Thun by neural interface, and its damage is his pain. The air is vibrating as the crucible rotates in a blur. He needs time. He slams two of the cardinal elements of the crucible into sympathy with the 34th hexagrammatic resonance, and the fire in Borealis Thun's bones cools. Its heat-blistered skin shimmers, damage vanishing as though it had never been. The demon serpent hisses, and the fire pours from its throat, so hot that its core is blue, its edges white. Ice forms where the flames wash the Titan's skin. The lichway is quaking. Alien pillars shatter and fall, splinters shattering and burning in the psychic gale. Lesser demons circle in the air and on the tunnel walls, eyes bright with fear and thirst. Bolt shells and las blasts rain down from Borealis Thun, cutting a circle through the waves of creatures boiling around it. The demon serpent rears in Hydrogyrum's hollow display. His hand plucks the rune of iron from the air as the crucible spins it past him. Iron is the basest element in all those that he can wield, its control represented by a lump of raw ore. Rough lines cross the lump's surface, forming words that have been dead to mankind for over 30 millennia. Hydrogyrum grips the iron and punches. The serpent is directly in front of Borealis Thun, hooded in fire, flowing like a silk ribbon snapping in the wind. The Titan's power fist lashes forward. Ghost ice scatters from fingers the size of tank barrels as they snap shut around the serpent's throat. Lightning sheets out. Cold fire arcs from the closed fist.
The serpent writhes, spewing flame, its shape flickering and sliding between muscle, feathers, flesh, and smoke. The titan squeezes, pouring its essence into its grasp, strangling the creature, eating its essence. Hydrogyrum is sweating. Feedback is bleeding into him across the neural link in his skull. The crucible's current alignment cannot hold for much longer. The elements are pulling apart. The universe abhors stability, and the controls of a Psi-Titan are the universe distilled and transmuted into symbols, levers, and movement. He holds on, siphoning the power of the Titan into its fist. He needs to hold it just a little longer. The demon becomes still in the Titan's grasp. And then, it is not a creature, but an expanding column of fire and black smoke. It reaches up, spreading across the lichway in an anvil-headed cloud. The blast wave tears lesser demons apart and spins them up into the embrace of a cyclone. Borealis Thune staggers. Its right arm is a stump of shredded metal. Hydraulic fluids gush from it. Its front is burning. Ghostlight writhes across its wounds. The metal of its skin flows, trying to knit back together as it straightens. Hydrogyrum is bleeding. The shockwave has burst his eardrums and the soft tissue in his nose. Blood is staining the whites of his eyes. The taste of wet iron fills his mouth.
"Custodian Chul," he hisses into the vox.
"Prefect," comes the reply, growling with static.
"Is the incursion into the lichway at its peak?"
Static fills his ears. The demon is congealing from the fire and smoke before Borealis Thune once more. Hydrogyrum wonders who will bear his name and the name of his machine. For a moment, for the first moment in a life where he has never understood what it is that mundane humans feel when they say they are moved by the moment, he finds that he would have preferred not to have needed to be here at this moment and at this place.
"The Neverborn's force is at its greatest, Prefect," says Chul, the words flat and echoing over the vox. "You may withdraw."
But here he is. Four cardinal elements slide into alignment around him. The obsidian globe spins to within reach of his hand one last time. At his feet, darkness spasms, smoke fuming from his skull, and then lies still. The image of the demon vanishes from the hololithic display.
"Null," says Hydrogyrum.
And Borealis Thune roars pure blackness as the fire falls.
The Imperial Palace, before. The sky was fading from blue to purple and black when Hydrogyrum stepped from the base of the Tower of the Sickle Moon and back onto the palace walls. He paused. The lights of starships and smaller aircraft winked across the darkening heavens. Halos ringed the brightest of the false stars as their light fell through the haze of pollution. The true stars were still emerging, their brilliance stolen by the glow rising from the palace. His eyes moved between the ancient patterns of constellations, noting the relative positions of each.
"What do you see in the stars?" came the voice of Chul from behind him.
Hydrogyrum did not turn. The custodian's armor buzzed with an electric melody as he came to stand next to the parapet. He had his helm in place, its red plume stirred in the wind rising from beneath the wall.
"I see," began Hydrogyrum, "I see that the winds of destruction are rising. I see that the hunter is bright in the heavens. I see that things change and things end."
The custodian shifted. The red crystal of his eye lenses turned to the darkening sky.
"You know that the arts of astromancy and astromathics are forgotten by most, and would be considered a denial of the precepts of the Imperium by many."
Hydrogyrum shrugged.
"Everything has its place in a greater design, a place where it belongs for a time. Just as Claude Carcinos must rise, and, as it does, the candle-bearer must fall. They are not free, or slaves, or good, or evil. They just are. That does not change, whether it is forgotten or agreed with.
You make superstition into wisdom.
I had a fine teacher, said Hydrogyrum, and paused, his tattooed face very still as his eyes moved across the constellations above. He once told me that he remembered when the stars had different names, and humans thought themselves alone in a universe that rotated around them, and them alone. Of all the lies of the past, Custodian, I think I like it best.
He stepped away from the parapet and began to walk along the wall towards the dark vault of the sky. Tuol watched him for a second, a lone man in black stepping across the worn stones, the night swallowing his shadow. And then the custodian turned and went his own way.
That was Ordo Sinister by John French, read by Jonathan Keeble.
The Heart of the Pharos by L.J. Goulding. Read by Jonathan Keeble.
He fell, my lord. Of that much at least we can be certain.
Captain Adullus's words rang with an echo that did not entirely match the physical confines of the chamber in which he stood. The effect was apparently disorienting, even for those who had used the Pharos many times before, making the smooth, polished walls appear shadowy and indistinct. Beyond them, through them, the high pillars of the Convincus Capicularum were clearly visible, many light-years away on the crag. He blinked hard, trying his best to focus on the matter at hand.
I can find no evidence to suggest that anything unusual occurred in the initial stages of the descent. It seems that the correct procedures were followed throughout.
Adullus stood at the center of the tuning stage in primary location Alpha, scanning the information on the data slate in his hands as though it were all new to him. In truth, he had read it more than a dozen times. They all had.
Behind his iron mask, Warsmith Dantioc sighed. The sergeant's report is comprehensive in detail, Captain Adullus, and yet it offers little in the way of real insight. I, for one, am still no closer to understanding what actually happened to young Obadiah. That, if nothing else, is a problem.
Quite so,
Adullus replied sternly. Four of them were haloed within the communication field, there on Sota. Three were Centurion-level officers from three different legions, a living testament to the ideals of Imperium Secundus. They stood as equals. Adullus of the Ultramarines, Barabbas Dantioch of the Iron Warriors, and Alexis Pollux of the Imperial Fists. A giant in his yellow battleplate, he remained always at the periphery, quietly tending to the esoteric functions of the Pharos, and noting each minute change in the polarity readings as his kinsman spoke. Adullus beckoned to the fourth of their number.
Neophyte Tebekai, step forwards.
Far more slender than his superiors, Tebekai wore the light carapace and fatigues of a legionary scout. He was a youth of no more than 15, still acclimatizing to his transhuman physiology with the air of someone not entirely comfortable in his own skin. His final surgery scars would still be pink across pale flesh not yet truly tempered in the forges of war, his combat doctrines and weapon drills still requiring conscious thought in training. He saluted stiffly, though he said nothing and kept his gaze firmly on the chamber floor. Scrolling back to the top of the report, Adullus tapped one knuckle thoughtfully against the edge of the slate as he began to read again.
Sergeant Arcus led your training cohort on a mapping rotation, following the original request from Warsmith Dantioch. Is that correct?
Yes, my lord.
What do you understand the purpose of this task to have been?
Tabakai still did not look up.
Security, Lord.
Explain.
There were concerns. Concerns about how far the spaces under the mountain went down. Because normal auspects won't work, no one knew. Not really.
He paused, nervously clenching his jaw several times.
No one knows, I mean.
Dulles looked to Dantioch. The warsmith sighed and took a step back to settle onto the plain throne that had become a permanent fixture upon the tuning stage of late. The wooden frame creaked beneath the weight of his armour.
"We used servitor drones to begin with," he explained. "As part of my earliest investigations into the workings of the Pharos, I had the Mechanicum adepts fit them with ranging markers and send them down on prefigured exploration routes. Primary location Alpha is connected to a vast network of chambers descending ever deeper into the mountain. Far beneath the surface and local sea level, in fact. The immediate tributaries feed into the Pharos system in five places. But below the Epsilon Cavern, it splits into dozens of separate passageways.
Dantioch gestured with his gauntlets, tracing large rounded shapes in the air.
Some of the passages double back on themselves in loops or great spiraling walls. I lost almost all of the drones. At first I supposed that their logic protocols were insufficient for the task at hand, but Magos Carantine was unwilling to volunteer any more advanced automata. If I'm honest, at this point my enthusiasm was directed rather more towards the potential uses of the device, rather than explaining the exact science behind it.
He paused, glancing back through the communications field to where another seated figure listened intently.
But as you know, after we managed to establish the two-way reciprocal contact with McCragg, it was decided that security measures should be stepped up if the Pharos was to be relied upon so heavily. There was agreement that if the extent of the network was still unknown, then it could not be effectively guarded, without closing off everything beyond the range of our previous mapping expeditions. I made my thoughts known. Such action would almost certainly reduce the accuracy of the device, or stop it working altogether.
But Dulles frowned. He had never been particularly skilled at hiding his frustration, even when under the scrutiny of his superiors.
"I wouldn't know anything about the workings of the Pharos, my lord,"
he said, choosing his words carefully, as he rechecked the details on the data slate one last time.
"But if the warsmith had made it clear that he had simply lost more than 40 servitors under the mountain in a 5-month period, then Sergeant Arcus might not have been so quick to offer the use of one of my company's scout cohorts instead. And in that case, we would not be here now trying to establish what manner of threat lurks in the darkness beneath our very feet, preying upon any who stray too far into its domain."
There was a long silence. Adulis was content to let it remain, but Warsmith Dantioch looked to Tebekai once more.
"It falls to you, then, Neophyte. Where your sergeant's report is lacking, we would hear your account of what happened to young Obadiah beneath Mount Pharos."
Tebekai let out a slow breath. His voice sounded small beneath the weight of their expectation.
"By the Primarch's command, I will tell you all that I remember."
They had taken the conveyor, then followed the main arterial gantry to its end, and rappelled down to the fallen remains of the first temporary structure on the floor of the old Epsilon Cavern. It was not far, only 400 meters or so. They had all made the journey before. The soft distant throb of the quantum pulse engines could be felt all around them, in the very rock itself, and their dropped magnesium flares marked out a rough circle amidst the debris. Wordlessly, they drew their bolt guns and paired off exactly as they had been trained. Sergeant Arcus took the handheld ranging markers from Florian's open pack and passed them around, keeping one for himself, before gesturing for the neophytes to disperse. It was standard Legion protocol to use only battle sign when on field reconnaissance duties, though there had been some question whether or not that applied here. Still, Arcas had said. It was good practice. That was why the scout's cohorts were allowed to range so far on the planet's surface, away from Sotopolis and even the Castellum. With the rest of the galaxy apparently crushed beneath the renegade War Master's boot, the Ultramarines needed fresh battle brothers like never before. Warriors that knew the 13th Legion's ways like the backs of their gauntlets. A greater war would come soon enough. A war of vengeance against the traitors who had taken Terra. His own thoughts far from such grave matters, Obadiah grinned at Tebekai as they picked their way around the edge of the cavern. They flipped on their harness lamps only when the last of the flares had burned out, and they could no longer hear the careful movements of the other scout teams heading away from them.
"The sergeant's gone," he said in a hushed voice. "So give me that ranging marker. I've been waiting weeks for my turn, and you lost our bet. Hand it over."
Tebekai grunted, thrusting the device into Obadiah's waiting hand.
"Just don't break it. Arco gave it to me, and I've taken enough grief for your clumsiness these past weeks."
He pulled a tattered sheet of parchment from his belt pack and shone his lamp onto the hand-drawn map, tracing the path ahead.
"Come on, move. We're supposed to be heading northwest today. Then sort of north?"
Obadiah looked up from the ranging marker's display.
"You're not lost already, are you?"
he snorted.
"Shut up. You know how these tunnels are. Calibrate the rangefinder and let's go."
Shaking his head in amusement, Obadiah shouldered his bolt gun and aimed the marker at the nearest wall. A near-invisible thread of pale green lights played from the emitter, and the device's tinny voice spoke,
"Range to target, 1.63 meters.
Tebekai checked the reading with a measuring line. Satisfied, the two of them trudged away and into the unknown depths beyond.
"What is that you're always humming?"
Obadiah asked, after a goodly hour or so of managing to ignore it. He stopped, leaning against the smooth black wall of the tunnel, and wiping his forehead on the back of his glove. Tebekai wrinkled his nose.
"What? This little ditty?"
He droned out a few bars of the same repetitive tune, then shrugged.
"I'm not sure. I think I've always known it, even before we joined the Legion. It's hard to recall much before that."
He pulled the drinking tube from his collar and drew a mouthful of tepid water.
"What do you remember?"
Obadiah gazed off into the blackness ahead. "Cabalas steeds. All I remember is Cabalas steeds."
"What?"
"It's a biologist's designation. Equus? Ferus? Cabalas. That's it. Horses. In the low tongue. That was my birth family's trade. Someone somewhere in Ultramar must have decided at some point that Sutta needed horses."
"What for?"
Obadiah turned, narrowing his eyes against the glare from Tebekai's lamp.
"How should I know? We had cold bloods for field work, and more spirited Caprizian breeds for riding."
He paused, sighing.
"But I think they must all be gone now, anyway. The horses... No, my family. They would have been shipped off once Dantioch took over the mountain, I suppose. Shame. Seems to me like Sota is just about the safest place in the galaxy to be right now."
They stood in silence for a moment, each trying to recall a time that was now lost to them forever. Layers of hypno-conditioning and psycho-indoctrination had scoured their mortal past and left them ready to be reforged in Gilliman's image. But although the future could hold nothing more for them than a life of unceasing battle and a glorious death at its end, no legionary neophyte ever felt anything as feeble as regret. Without realizing it, Tebekai began to murmur the half-remembered tune again, his subconscious straining to form words around the melody. Obadiah laughed.
"I've never been one for music or poems. You should teach it to the herdsmen from the settlement. They love a good sing-song." "I'm not going near them, the filthy scrodders."
Mischief glinted in Tebekai's eye.
"I always thought you had a bit of a whiff about you, too. Now I know it's because you're a little stable boy."
He slung his bolt gun and cracked his knuckles, making it clear that another of their playful brotherly scraps was certainly on the cards. Before Obadiah could respond, the mountain began to quake. The quantum heartbeat of the Pharos shifted, setting the glassy walls of the tunnel resonating with an almost painful thrum. Such an effect was commonplace whenever Dantioch or Captain Pollux tried to push the device too far. But this was different. This was more intense. Obadiah dropped the ranging marker, clamping his hands over his ears. The sound still beat in his chest nonetheless, as though he were screaming silently at the top of his lungs. From further away, in the unseen reaches of the tunnel, they heard the clatter of falling rock on the smooth curve of the floor, and the almost tectonic rumble of the planet's crust shifting around them. Tebekai fell to his knees, mouthing something that Obadiah couldn't make out. Gradually the quake subsided. They both remained there, crouched and poised, ready for any aftershocks. None came. Reaching for his Voxlink, Tebekai cursed.
"That damn fool Warsmith! He knows we're down here!"
He clicked open a channel.
"Calling Cohort Arcus 55.
Obadiah scuttled to his side, checking over the ranger marker for any damage.
"What are you doing? We're not supposed to break Vox silence except in an emergency." "What do you call this?"
Tebekai snapped back at him.
"We're more than 9 kilometers beneath the surface. We'll be buried alive if they try that again. Cohort Arcus 55, please acknowledge."
The link crackled. The channel was empty.
"The Pharos beam could still be on,"
Obadiah muttered, aiming the marker down the tunnel.
"If so, then the Vox won't work anyway."
"Range to target, 88.34 meters.
Tebekai raised a hand.
"Shh! Turn that thing down."
"What? Why?"
"Quiet!"
They both held their breath. The link still returned nothing but a flat hiss. Except... His eyes wide, Tebekai looked up.
"There. You hear that?"
It was a faint binaric warble, only just audible at the very limits of the frequency. Obadiah frowned.
"What is it?"
he whispered.
"It's an automated mechanicum cant,"
Tebekai replied.
"That's one of the lost servitor drones."
They followed the weak signal for at least another 2 kilometers down and to the northwest, as far as Obadiah could make out, with the ranging marker set against the almost nonsensical curve of the tunnel. They had strayed well off the edge of their map, and Tebekai had given up trying to record their route. His rough calculations suggested that they'd actually gone in a circle more than 3 times. There was a chill in the depths, a deep cold, the like of which they had never encountered, even beyond the great engine halls of Primary Location Ultra. As far as either of them could make out, no living human had ever set foot this deep beneath the mountain. Were they even beneath the mountain at all any longer?
"It's like being inside a huge beast,"
Obadiah murmured.
"Some huge frozen beast of the void." "Be quiet,"
Tebekai hissed.
"I'm just saying. Doesn't it feel, like, organic to you? Down here, I mean. More so than above ground level. The tunnels remind me..." "Be quiet!"
They both stopped abruptly at the faint sound of struggling servos. Their lamps picked out an opening low in the smooth wall of the tunnel, almost capillary-like. Tebekai made a show of not seeing the similarity with what Obadiah had just been saying, and closed the Vox link.
"Well volunteered, brother,"
he said with a grin.
"Get down that gap and snag the drone. Forget our poor measurements. The data in that servitor could be 10, 20, or 100 times more useful. We'll drag it back to the surface and let the Warsmith do whatever it is he does with it all. Tebekai and Obadiah, the heroes of Sota."
Sighing, Obadiah shook his head.
"Oh, you're an idiot."
Tebekai shrugged.
"I'm not the one crawling down a tiny hole in the guts of a Xenos machine on the edge of known space. Mind how you go."
Obadiah handed his bolt gun off and eased himself headfirst into the opening, Tebekai lowering him as far as he could by the bootstraps. Then, bracing with his elbow pads,
He scraped and slid his way down the steep angle of the crawlspace, his lamp all but useless against the glassy black rock, towards the unmistakable sound of the stuck servitor.
"Oh, it's a good job you kept on chirping, you old clanker," he marvelled. "Otherwise we'd never have found you in the dark."
Eventually the crawlspace opened out. Obadiah caught a gasp before it could leave his throat. The drone was perched on the edge of an abyss, no more than 4 paces away from him, its tracked feet moving weakly back and forth in the emptiness beyond. How it had not simply fallen, he could not begin to guess. Vertigo gripped at Obadiah's stomach as he inched forwards. His dual heartbeat began to thump in his chest. Beyond the ledge in front of him, there was simply nothing. No distant rocky walls, no suggestion of light. No physical object that even his enhanced vision could pick out. This space, whatever it was so unimaginably vast that he had difficulty reconciling its existence with what he knew about the geographical layout of Mount Pharos. It just seemed too big to fit under the mountain, in any literal sense. The warsmith would have to revise his calculations. No wonder they had lost so many of the drones down here. Tebekai's voice came faintly down the crawlspace after him.
"Have you got it?"
Obadiah gingerly pulled himself up and knelt beside the drone. Its power cells were at less than 1%, but its mapping memory was reading as almost full.
"Yes, yes, I've got it. I'm going to shut it down first so we don't risk data coil corruption."
As the servitor's systems lapsed into hibernation, its feet went still. Only then did Obadiah realize just how completely silent this immense space was. He clapped his gloved hands together, but the sound cast no echo. He shook his head and pulled the rappel line from his harness, fastening it to the servitor's chassis. He wouldn't risk losing it on the climb back up to Tebekai.
"I'm coming now,"
he called, heaving the servitor around as carefully as he could. Tebekai's reply was too faint for him to hear. Obadiah paused at the crawlspace opening. He cast a glance back over his shoulder. His curiosity got the better of him, and he reached for the ranging marker on his hip.
Aiming blindly, he watched the pale thread of light flick out into the impenetrable darkness.
"Range to target. 9999999999.
The marker's voice became distorted. Then Obadiah flinched as the emitter burst out with a firecracker bang and a shower of sparks. He twisted, putting out a hand to catch himself, but his fingers closed on nothingness. His balance lurched to one side, and he kicked harder than he meant to in reflex. He sprawled outwards, and he fell. Obadiah's wordless cry was deadened by the abyss. There was nothing around him in any direction to reach out for. The rappelling line spooled out at an alarming rate, doing nothing to arrest his fall. Panicking, he flailed, reaching, grasping for the catch on his harness that would engage the braking gears. Before he could find it, the line struck taut. The sudden halt was agonizing. He felt both of his shoulders wrench from their sockets, the left one popping immediately back in as he sprung 2 meters back upwards on the end of the rappel. The air was torn from his winded lungs. The broken ranging marker slipped from his grasp and tumbled down into the infinite void beneath him. Obadiah hung there, gasping and whimpering in pain, like a crushed arachnid on the end of its final silken thread. He hung there for a long time. He did not like to question how the servitor had remained tethered back up on the ledge, saving him from an endless plunge into who even knew where, nor did he like to question how long it would be before it toppled over after him, joining him in oblivion. His arms were numb and limp. He was all but helpless. His only hope was that Tebekai would have been so startled by his cries that he might dare venture down the crawlspace after him and haul him back up. A slim hope. Tebekai seemed to be as dumb as a bag of rocks when it truly mattered. Even Chryseos, whom the rest of the cohort often mocked for his slow wits, would occasionally show him up in training exercises. Obadiah laughed thinly at that thought, tears stinging his eyes. He had the impression that his vision was swimming before him, except that there was nothing but impenetrable blackness above and below. At least when he screwed his eyes shut, he was rewarded with a brief riot of colour behind his eyelids to let him know that he hadn't gone blind. He could feel unconsciousness rising in him.